The Archer by Telemia, read by Jax Longcoat, a Disco Elysium fanfic. Tags include Clausia/Ruby, post-canon, canon-typical references to drugs and violence. Summary: in which Clausia parties at the end of the world, Ruby tries to fix a broken radio, and nobody is saying even half the things they ought to say. When people think the world is about to end, they throw a party. You should know. You began to suspect that the world might be ending when you were 16, and by 17 you were thoroughly convinced. It's been one big party after another ever since for you. This party, like most of the ones held by the revolutionaries, is a bit shit. It has a certain, and in fairness, this is mostly down to lack of resources and the taped-up windows and the minimal lighting, none of which anyone can reasonably be expected to address, je ne sais school disco to it. Actually, the fact it's being held in the old gymnasium probably doesn't help. But large venues with mostly intact walls, floors, and ceilings have been in short supply of late, as have good drugs and alcohol. So here they are, some few dozen future martyrs, the great hope of Revachol, in a dusty old gymnasium with the windows taped up in black and the lights on low, too sober to really want to dance to the quiet, dated music when it plays. Backs against the climbing bars, eyeing each other warily. And you, wanting to be wanted so bad that you think you might just die of it. God, some things never change. Still, a little cluster is trying to make it work on the dance floor, all women, obviously, giggling and shimmying around in a little loop. And a few people are already speculatively pairing off. Titus, arm around his girl, pretending pretty poorly that he's not half watching you out the corner of his eye. A pair of the newer recruits, too young to be in here by half, her with her hair in neat slicked and lanky plaits, him with his thin worn shirt collar pressed and starched even though it clearly doesn't fit. The most boring cop alive and her pockmarked looming shadow acting out their familiar listless orbit where they somehow never quite collide. They should name a new type of tragedy after those two. DeLorean doesn't cut it. Only in Revachol could they invent a tragedy so mundanely miserable that it isn't even actually sad. It's just sort of embarrassing. At the center of the room, of course, is Harry, resplendent in the disco lights. When he catches your eye and beckons you, you go. He might be the only other person in the room who truly gets the party thing like you do. It's also possible he's the only person here who actually likes you. But that's not your concern. You don't need to be liked. You just need to be adored. And they always love you on the dance floor. Besides, you have a soft spot for Harry. Not really because of what he did for Lely, though you're grateful, if nothing else, that he finally cut the body down. God, the way he'd just been hanging there. The way the tree creaked in the wind. And the smell was... No. No, none of that. Not out here on the dance floor, anyway. In any case, your affection doesn't stem from that. It's just that you and Harry are so alike. You can see it in his big hangdog eyes and his droopy smile and his red, depressing nose. There but for the grace of God go I. Well, God is graceless, and here you are. 29 hangs off you like the devil. You can paint it up and blur it out in party lights, but it's already setting in. The rot. It has been since the day you turned 21 and realized you were getting old. You should have partied harder when you had the chance. At this rate, you're not even going to leave a pretty corpse. I think you're very beautiful, he says, as he spins you round and catches you by the waist. I think you're very beautiful, too, you tell him, with a suggestive little smile to hide your sincerity. How come we've never fucked? Well... he says, slowly. You turned me down. And I don't think I really wanted to, honestly. Even though I, asked. He winces. It's almost like you can see it. I want to have fuck with you, looping on the video player behind his eyes forevermore. It might torment him, but you think it's kind of hilarious. He shakes his head. Not my finest hour. This time, you twirl him. What about now? You want to... He shakes his head again. More certain this time. You shrug. Yeah, me neither. Still, that's never stopped me yet. It's true. If you had to rank all the reasons you've had sex with people over the course of your life, your own desire to have sex with them would probably barely make the top five. It would certainly rank below because it was funny and drugs. This makes him look sad. It is a bit sad, honestly, even if it's more sad pathetic than it is sad upsetting, so you allow it. You know, he says, after a moment, Trant used to tell me that the psychological root of most self-injurious behavior is actually... You frown. Trant? He nods. Trant. Nice suits, goofy grin? I found it sort of charming, actually. You cock your head. Wasn't he the guy that sold you all out to the MI? Oh, yeah, says Harry, cheerfully. But he's my friend, and he always gave great psychological advice. And I think he got his kid a real nice nest egg sorted with the payout, too. You can't hate a guy for the hustle. You're a communist, you say, flatly. Krasmazov was the ultimate hustler, he tells you, in a tone of such utter seriousness that you almost find yourself believing it. A true comrade knows you can hustle for things other than money. You have to hustle for the people. You laugh. Uh-huh, he says, his big, heavy hands resting companionably on your hips. Taking care of each other is the biggest hustle of them all. You wonder when the last time was you had a friend who told you like this and who, really, sincerely, down to the bottom of his alligator-patterned shoes, wouldn't think it meant you'd fuck him later on tonight. Years ago, you think. You hate it. So you lean in and sway with him, arms around his neck, chin on his shoulder. That way you don't have to look him in the eye. Because Harry looks at you the same way he looks at his other hangers-on, his pet depressive and his gaggle of delinquent teens, preteens, whatever, squawking and unsure, miserable people, lonely and afraid. The opposite of desirable and glamorous and all the fragile, shiny things you wish you really were. You hate it, but you can't hate him, even though you have plenty enough cause to. After all, it's him who got you caught up in all this revolution shit when you should be half the world away by now. After Martinez, he'd scared you shitless. Easy to forget that. He's a scary fucking guy sometimes. You'd been scrambling to escape and he just tracked you down, easy as that. Laid waste to all your exit plans and your bribe money and your many, many passports. The fake ones with fake names, the fake ones with fake pictures, the fake one with your real name and picture on it. He's still the only person who's ever found that even half as funny as you did. Kim had not been so amused. And when he finally caught up to you and you had asked him why, he cocked his head and just said, I don't know, I like a mystery. He didn't even pretend to try and turn you in. It wasn't about that. And so, in the end, you found you couldn't hate him for cutting your escape off any more than he could hate you for having lied to him. When the dance ends, he spins you around one final time, bows deeply, and blows you a big, whiskery kiss. You catch it with a grin. I don't know if you really won that pageant, he says, solemnly, but I hope you did. You'd have deserved it. Miss Aranya? You laugh. Believe it, baby. Crown and scepter, the whole nine yards. Top scores across the board. They'd never seen my like before or since. You promise? Sure. Why not? Then I do, he says, with a very serious nod. I do believe it, baby. You can tell he really does, with all his heart. And... at least until you make it off the dance floor. You believe it too. At which point you bump straight into Ruby, who looks thoroughly annoyed, and you suddenly feel a lot less like Miss Aranya Disco Dancer, and a lot more like Miss Massive Trainwreck Idiot who fucks things up. They don't even give you a sash for that one, so it's a pretty shitty trade. She breezes past you before you can stop her, catch her arm, her eye. In that moment, there you are again, 15 maybe, 14, before you knew the world was going to end. Back against the gymnasium bars with the taste of metal in your mouth, hoping for a dance that isn't going to come. Here's something that you've learned. You get to grow up too fast once, but the world will make an aching, too tall child of you over and over and over again. You never really get away from that. By the time that you catch up to her, she's gone outdoors, sat atop a pile of rubble just outside the party with her hand cupped around the ember of her cigarette in case of bombers up above. But the sky tonight looks pretty empty. The clouds are low, the stars are hidden. And you two, as the door swings shut against the sound of music in the old gymnasium, are all alone. She nods as you approach her, but that's all. "I didn't know that you were here," you say. She shrugs. "Didn't know I'd come." "Oh?" You raise an eyebrow. "You had something better on?" "Nah, I don't know." She looks at you, sidelong. "Thought you might have skipped town by now." You look up toward the sky, as if there's something there to see, and draw a blank. When you turn back to her, you see she's looking upward, too. You sigh. "I'm sorry about bumping into you." "Hmm? Oh, yeah," she waves a hand. "I didn't notice. I mean, I did, but it's not... It's whatever. I don't mind." "You're just being nice," you say, settling next to her on a little waist-high outcrop of what must once have been a wall. Your heels catch in the debris as you sit and make you stumble. Her hand is at your hip for just a moment as she steadies you. "I'm really not. It's fine. You were..." She draws the hand back. "Weren't you busy? Looked like you were having fun. I hope you didn't come out here for me." You take a long, exaggerated survey of the rubble-ridden street around you. "Well, I'm not seeing anyone else." That garners you a laugh, and you lean in so that your shoulder bumps with hers. She doesn't quite pull back, but she freezes slightly at your touch. It's not exactly a rejection, just a redrawing of county lines. You'll take it, though. It's better than it was. You two haven't exactly talked about anything. Still, she's been graceful enough to learn to tolerate your presence, and you, in turn, have learned to tolerate the fact that toleration is about the best you can hope for after what you did. You don't regret it. You did what you always do, survived. But you're not used to having to deal with the consequences of your survival, and you will admit it stings. It's probably worse because you keep prodding at it, but what can you say? Making things worse is a habit of yours. You'd call it masochism, but in your experience, masochism is at least actually fun. "You know," you say, light in your tone as if you're only making an observation and not a mortifyingly earnest offer, "there's still plenty of people dancing back in there." "Uh-huh," she says, blowing out a lazy cloud of smoke. "I guess there are." "Why? You want to dance?" You glance at her through your lashes. Grin, nice and slow and easy. "Well, sure. Yeah, I do." "You should go back in there and find a guy to dance with, then," she says, and she makes a jerky gesture at the old gym door. "Go on, don't let me hold you back." She drops the butt end of her cigarette down into the rubble as she stands to leave, crushing the glowing light beneath her boot. "I was going back to mine soon anyway. C's got a new pet radio I've been trying to fix up." It feels like the floor is giving way. "Ruby," you say, cutting off your sentence even as you stumble to your feet, because you want to stop her leaving but you don't know how. She glances over her shoulder at you, and you watch her take you in, her eyebrows vanishing briefly beneath her unruly, handsome mop of hair. "Oh, you... Right. I see," she says, with a sudden and unwarranted hint of gruffness in her tone. "Well, you can come with me if that's... if you want to watch me fix a shitty radio, I guess." When you get to her room, she lets you in, but makes no particular move to welcome you, just settles at her bomb side of a desk and flicks her soldering iron on with a sigh. You linger in the doorway, unsure. Did you? She cuts you off, shifting a stack of uneven, crabby notes from one side of the table to another. I told you, she says, I'm coming back here to work on the broken radio again. You tilt your head, uncertain. Is that your way of asking me to leave? She shrugs. Not really. You watch, enraptured, as she unspools a little roll of wire. She's got clever fingers. They're short and practical and marked all over with a million little nicks and cuts and ancient burns, but they're clever. You admire people with clever hands. You've always hated yours. They're the very worst of all your tells. They're spidery and ungainly, and they shake. You can come in, you know, she says. Don't hover by the door. So you step a little closer and let the door swing shut behind you. I'd offer you somewhere to put your jacket, she says, presently. But you haven't got one, so, oh, I don't know. Whatever makes you comfortable. She doesn't quite glance round to face you, but you can hear the echo of a grin. I guess I wouldn't hate it if you lost the dress. Hangers on the door. This dress is not nice enough to warrant hanging up, so you just drop it. Your heels and your underwear follow it to the floor in quick succession. You're far too sober to make a show of it, and in any case, Ruby isn't looking. She's digging through the guts of an old-fashioned pink-shelled radio. You watch her solder down a wire somewhere inside it, flip a switch, and shake her head. She flicks the iron off and rifles through her notepad, tapping lightly on the desk with the blunt end of a well-chewed pencil. Entirely in her own world. As for you, you wind up standing there in the pathetic little puddle of your clothes, with your arms slowly curling around your body, waiting for something. You really are too sober for this shit. You clear your throat. She glances over her shoulder, does a visible double take, then twists her whole body round to face you, arm on the chair back. Hey, she says, I like your outfit. You roll your eyes. Oh, very funny. What? I mean it. It's nice. Come over here and let me take a better look. Your pickup lines are awful, you tell her, taking her hand when she reaches out to you and feeling your pulse flutter in your stomach with unwarranted tenderness when she runs her thumb over your knuckles. And yet? She gestures at you as you settle, perching on the edge of her cluttered desk. Here you are. Guess so, you say, and bite your tongue before you can follow it up with some flippant remark about your shitty taste. You do have shitty taste, but Ruby is the exception that proves the rule. And she takes your crap to heart too easy, far easier than she lets on, you've come to realize. There's a space heater over here, she says, nodding at the rusted little thing beside her desk as if admitting to a great and terrible weakness. So you should be, well, don't want you to get cold. She hesitates before she touches you, and you say nothing, just tilt your head back, part your legs. When her hand comes up to graze against your hip, you sigh, contented, close your eyes. It's all right, she's here. Her hand trails up your thigh, fingers tracing lightly along the jagged edges of the biggest, oldest scar without any particular inflection or intent. It's a stab wound, not deep as such, but badly healed, and the ache still lingers when it rains. There's no gross curiosity in her touch, nor undue pity, nor disgust. She finds it like a sailor finds an old familiar anchor point. It's just somewhere she's stopping for a while. And why not? She's been here before. In the hazy visions that your mind can conjure up, it was daylight at the whirling, sunlight streaming in while you lounged up by the headrest with a menthol cigarette. And there, by some strange act of grace, was she, loose-limbed and naked on the bed, outlined in brilliant, blazing light. And her hand was warm and lazy on your thigh, and she'd said, "How'd you manage that one?" with an easy, companionable tone. And you said, only it hadn't been like that, not really. It was night the few times that you ever brought her up to yours, and you'd been drunk and high and stupid, and you hadn't grasped a thing about what any of it was worth, or why you might soon wish you could remember it far better than you do. Still, you do recall some little things, and one of them is this. It wasn't sunlit, and you didn't have a menthol cigarette. You don't know if you volunteered the story, or if she asked. But you remember how she'd laughed when you said you'd patched it up. What, by yourself? That's mental, Clasia. You can't even darn a fucking skirt. And you'd said, well, I was 18. And she'd said, oh, so old enough to know better. And you'd said, hey, I lived. And she'd said, I'm looking and I think the skirt came out less lumpy. And you'd said, well, I hope so. I practiced on my leg. And you'd both laughed so hard you thought you might be sick. Actually, now you think of it, perhaps you were sick and she had to hold your hair. Or was that Titus? Or the other one, the one who... Never mind. It doesn't matter now. It wasn't Lely, that's for sure. Lely never held your hair, or laughed with you about your stupid fucked up leg, or asked you if you'd like to run away together. And you miss him anyway, in ways that you didn't think it was possible to miss another human being. Funny, that. You're not sure if that says something about him, or something about you, or if it's just that when somebody fucking dies inside you, you can never quite move on. Like a bit of you is always going to be stuck there, in that room, hanging in a frozen moment where the glass is still coming down, but the light's already gone behind his eyes. And in the past, in your heart, in the room at the Whirling, you are stuck for half a breath beneath that warm, unfeeling weight that used to be a man, and you think, oh my God, I'm going to think of this every time somebody touches me from this day on, forever. What the fuck? Oh, what the fuck? That's gonna fuck me up. As if it could be worse. Still. In the present, Ruby's hand is resting on your thigh. And when you glance at her, your stomach jolts to find she's looking up. You wonder what she sees. Not much, in all likelihood. There's so little of you left, and the lamp's so bright behind your head she's halfway squinting just to look at you. But you'd like to ask her, all the same. She's inscrutable because she's honest, and you don't know how to read an honest face. You want, so terribly, to shake her and to ask, God, do you see me? Have you seen me, really, down in the deep places? Do you like her? I don't know her. I don't know the way to get there anymore. Do you like her? Would you tell her? Would you tell her how terribly sorry I am for all the things I made her do? Have you seen her? Did you see me? And did you like her? Did you like me? And if you didn't, do you think you'd like to try? Instead, you swallow and say nothing. It's her who breaks the silence. Why'd you come here, Kay? You shrug. For this, I think. She raises an eyebrow, gestures at her desk. For what? To watch me fix a radio? You want, very badly, to tell her something true. So you say this, the simplest, easiest of the many reasons why you're here. I wanted you to touch me. And there's this little awful silence where you know you've fucked it up. It's wrong. You don't know why, but it's the wrong answer, somehow, even though it's true. Then she smiles, a little weary, and tugs you down toward her lap. Okay, she says. Yeah, sure, that figures. I can do that. She licks her fingers, businesslike, and lays her hand down with the back against her thigh. Palm up so that you have something soft to buck against when you wind up straddling her leg. The angle's a little awkward, and every time you shift your weight to compensate, you can feel her slowly curling a couple fingers into you. She's excruciatingly measured with it, and the angle means she barely gets them in up to the second knuckle even once she's done, laughing as she watches you trying to rock her in a little deeper. "This is all I got, sweetheart," she tells you, not without a little pity in her smile. You have more, more fingers, you say, and you roll your body down into her hand. You don't force the shudder or the gasp, but when it comes, you let it happen, arms slung loose over her shoulders, jaw a little slack. You know you're beautiful, and you know it doesn't work on her. She says, sure, well, let me rephrase. This is all I got for you. But you're a smart girl, Clasia. You can make it work. Please, you murmur. They always like you desperate, and you always like it when she calls you Clasia. It's no more or less your real name than the one your parents gave you, but it's the one she used back when she asked you... Never mind. You like it. There. That's all. You buck your hips as you lean in to kiss her, but she brushes you aside. Come on. You don't want that shit. You let me focus on the radio, all right? All right, you say, all breathy, undone with desire. You don't mind the fact she turns her head away, that she's half ignoring you, her free hand drifting back toward the desk, her notes, the radio. You like it when people get a little mean. A lot mean, even. Though, funnily enough, you're not certain that she's exactly being mean. Or that's not all it is, anyway. You get the strangest sensation, just before she tugs you closer and her chin ends up resting on your shoulder so that you can't see her face, that she really wants you to believe that you're more into this than she is. Which is a funny thing to want when it's so obviously already true. Either way, she doesn't make any move to shift her hand or her leg, just lets you writhe helplessly on top of her thigh until you finally manage to get something like a rhythm going. If you lean forward just right and press down when you roll your hips, you can grind into her palm and still keep her fingers most of the way inside you. It's not pressure quite how you want it, but if you keep moving, it's almost, almost. You plant your face down into the crook of her neck with an indignant huff of air. You can feel the laughter rumble through her chest almost before you hear it, a great, deep, warming thing. Oh, life's not fair, huh, sweetness? You're not fair, you grumble, punctuating each word with frustrated, too small thrusts against her hand. Her free arm shifts against your side. You frown. What are you even... Looking at my notes, she says, trying to work out what the fuck went wrong with this transistor. Probably should do something with the wiring, but I reckon soldering is a two-hands kind of job. Then can you... Only it's too much, trying to talk and balance and move and breathe, and you end up just making a series of increasingly frustrated whining noises and petering out into a breathy little, please. She hums. I'm just real busy, baby. Ruby. Clasia. Please. She makes no move to help you out, but you feel her nosing up against your jawline when she speaks, mouth ajar and pressed against your pulse point like she isn't sure if she wants to kiss or bite. Come on, you don't need me. You're doing so good, aren't you, by yourself? And you say, ah, shifting back and rocking forward so hard you almost knee her in the crotch. You. Her voice cracks just a little and she clears her throat. Yeah, that's it. That's my girl. It's the voice crack that does it. You don't have the grace to be ashamed of that. You've done far stupider things for far worse people. So, there it is. It's the voice crack that pushes you over the edge because it means she's noticed you, that she cares. She wants you, even if it's just a little bit. Even if it's not more than she wants to fix a radio. You rock yourself through it in unsteady, shuddering waves, and you let yourself be happy. You can live on scraps, you know, on half-imagined sunlight, on the fact that her breath is coming in a little heavy, too, and the way she curls her free hand round your waist as you come down from it, the way she mouths artlessly along your jawline until you end up almost nose to nose. You make these noises, she tells you, and for a half second you hang there, wrapped up in the glorious potential of it all, the hand between your thighs still radiating heat, the nervous tremble of her breath entwined with yours, the way her lips are chapped and her eyes are gentle, and she looks as though she might just... She pulls back with a soft, unsteady laugh. Fuck. Sorry. What? She bumps her nose into your cheek. Nah, nothing. You look pretty. Go on. And she shifts you off her lap. You stumble backward with your legs still slick and trembling, and you can already feel the cold dread creeping in, but you smile. Smile. Go on, keep looking pretty, and she might keep you here a little longer, where it's warm. She smiles back, though it looks a little hollow. Yeah? You good? I'm good. She wipes her fingers on the dry leg of her cargo pants. Cool. That's cool. There's a long, glassy silence. Thin somehow. Brittle. Eventually, she laughs, and that sounds brittle too. You can put your dress back on, you know. What? She shrugs. You're good. I'm good. We're done. You don't need to hang around. You feel naked, suddenly. You've been naked this whole time, but you feel it now, and you find yourself crossing your arms across your chest as if that might help the situation. Somehow, strangely, it's worse. Now she knows you know you're naked. You want me to leave? She makes a vague, inarticulate gesture. I'm saying, look, it's not late. There's dancing, probably. You can go back to your party. It's not far. You want me to go back to the party? She sighs. You want to go back to the party. You have never, in your life, wanted to go to a party less than you do now. But how do you start explaining that? Your tongue is heavy and unwieldy in your mouth, and you've forgotten how your body moves. You know, we used to talk, you say, eventually. Ruby looks utterly perplexed. What? At the... before. We used to talk. Before. Oh, she says. Well, sure. Yeah, your, what did you call it?
My rooftop containment facility.
Your rooftop containment facility. For a moment, she half smiles. Yeah, I remember.
I liked that, you say. Talking.
Oh, don't. Ruby, briefly, puts her head down in her hands.
God, don't pull that fucking face.
What face? Sometimes I think you do this crap because you enjoy being shitty to me. Like it's all some stupid goddamn game to you. I just...
No.
No?
I swear, it isn't that.
Then what, Kay? What do you want?
The wanting is a great consuming thing. But what it is you want has always been intangible. You've tried it all. And somewhere, deep down in the core of you, is a pit that eats it up and leaves you hungry all the same. So you just shrug. Your voice is very small. I don't really know.
Okay, she says, with a huff of air that doesn't seem quite sure if it wants to be a half-baked sigh or a very dismal laugh. All right, okay.
I'm sorry.
She doesn't ask what for.
Yeah, well.
She picks her pencil up again and scribbles something down.
Fuck me.
You don't...
What?
You don't want to go back to the party?
You shake your head.
She stares up at the ceiling for a moment, then back down toward her desk. She mutters something to herself you can't quite catch, but you're pretty certain includes the words straight girl and again and massive fucking idiot. Eventually, she sighs and gestures gruffly at the pile of laundry, half folded and abandoned on her bed.
Ah, fuck it. Those are clean.
What? The back of her neck is very slightly red. T-shirt's probably comfier than the dress if you want to stick around a while. You liberate a shirt from the dirty laundry pile instead, and when you pull a chair up next to her, she doesn't comment on it, which is some relief. If you had to sit and justify why you need this thing to smell like her, you think you might actually die of sheer humiliation on the spot. There are parts,
some evidently broken, others still in packs straight from the shop, strewn all across the table. The backing for the radio she's working on is perched atop a little pile of screws, and you turn it over to take a better look. It's old, but it's been nicely kept. It has a brittle, plasticky pinkness to it, like a child's toy, and the manufacturer's stamp still has a little of the gold patina left when you run your thumb over the imprinted letters. When you go to put it back, your knuckle brushes up against the soldering iron. It's been off for a while now, but the end's still hot, and you flinch back with a hiss. Ruby catches your hand in hers without even looking up. When she bends to kiss the knuckle, you feel your breath catch. "Should be more careful," she says, simply. "You've got pretty hands." The end. From the author's notes. Okay, first off, I could speak for many hours about the ways in which Clasia and Harry parallel each other, and I won't get into it all here, but I will say I really like the idea of them getting a chance to actually be friends. I think there's a commonality there which they could both gain something from. Clasia's thoughts about growing up fast slash feeling like a tall child are obviously very much inspired by Mitski's first love late spring. The C Ruby is fixing the radio for is Kuno S. I think Ruby is not at all maternal, and Kuno S would not at all tolerate a parental figure, and for that reason I think they might be able to get along quite well. It's more like having a weird fun cousin or something. Honestly, I just think it would be very nice for Kuno S to have an adult in her life who she could trust, not just with like the actually serious shit she has going on, but also who would never even think to mock her for terrible secrets like moderate enjoyment of the color pink. I think Clasia is so difficult to get a read on in-game, partly because increasingly you start to think that she's basically just lying about everything, often in ways that aren't easy to perceive and for reasons you don't fully understand. So I suppose my read on her is that perhaps she's someone who's lied so frequently and so well throughout a really formative part of her life that she no longer has a substantial conscious handle on which bits of it are true. I think the best liars believe everything they say in the moment that they're saying it, and so inevitably she's going to hit a point where, like, every version of her is real and also every version of her is not real. Like, in this fic, at one point she thinks about herself as having a real name when she's thinking about the fake passports, and then later she thinks basically that she doesn't have one. And those aren't exactly lies, right? She's not even saying them out loud. They're just ways she thinks about her own sense of self, but they're almost totally inconsistent from one moment to the next. I think that's probably an extremely difficult space to be coming from when you're trying to work out what you think of somebody else romantically, or what they think of you. And I really think she did love Lely in her way, and that is also a lot. Ruby is in many ways more straightforward, but not necessarily always less messy. She clearly cares a lot, and because of that, I think she comes over as somebody who is very easily and very deeply hurt by disloyalty and betrayal. But she's also impulsive and sort of naturally curious, and so gestures broadly at whatever the fuck is going on here. Anyway, I hope these crazy kids work it out. I think they're both really interesting people with a lot of baggage, and I guess for me there's just something really compelling about the idea of them trying to work something out anyway. Like, despite everything else, they evidently have a genuine fondness for each other, even if it's not always paired with genuine understanding. And since I read that, I might as well do some reader's notes for the second time ever. This was the first time I read this fic. It was a cold read, although it will have been edited. I made a podfic of Telemia's other Ruby Clasia fic, Flight Paths of Migratory Birds, in 2023, and I really liked that one, but somehow I hadn't read this fic yet. That was also the last Disco Elysium podfic that I made until one that I made for Voice Team Mystery Box just a few weeks ago, and Disco Elysium had a big impact on me, and I was involved in the fandom for a while, as you can see from my body of podfics, but I haven't been so much for the past few years, so I kind of ended up making that other podfic just because I was looking for things to record for Voice Team, and so I was, you know, going back to authors that I'd enjoyed before, which is also what happened here. And so I kind of feel a little bit out of touch with it, I guess. I mean, I went to the beloved Disco Elysium Explorer to kind of try to remember how Ruby and Clausia sound. But, you know, I definitely felt like I was getting into things a little bit more as this went on. And I am recording this before I listen to what I just read, so maybe it will sound perfectly fine, but I did feel like I didn't really have any sort of handle on how I was trying to make Harry sound. So anyway, I feel slightly like a visitor here for not really any good reason, but I do just love this world and just the amount of texture in these characters, which is touched so well in this fic. I really like the care and attention given to something so difficult, I guess. Something about Disco Elysium in general, and then also this relationship and this story, it's tempting to think it would be easier to just give up, but there's still so much life available when you can stick with it. So anyway, I ended up finding this again because I was looking for things to record for Fem/February Podfic Edition. And together with the other one that I've been working on for that, I feel like I need to look for something happier to add to my contribution. But I also think that this is the kind of thing I like, and this is good to have too. Anyway, we'll see. But I liked reading this, and hopefully you like listening to it. And that's all I've got for now. Written work posted March 2023, audio recorded January 2026. Thanks for listening.